It may not be the most famous quote attributed to John F. Kennedy, but you may remember the late president once said, "The rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God." It's a statement that some have identified as an attempt to divest politicians of responsibility when it comes to the basic well-being of citizens. And in an era of ongoing austerity, it's perhaps fitting that we look at the role of government in protecting the basic rights of individuals. To discuss this, I'm joined in studio by Aoife Nolan, who's Professor of International Human Rights Law at the University of Nottingham, and who was speaking on this topic at the Parnell Summer School. Aoife, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Now, that quote from JFK, it comes from a different era. Do you hold the state to be 100% accountable for enshrining rights in law and protecting those rights?
Well, I think it's a very interesting quote, because what you see there is it's from the inaugural speech, and it's clear in that speech that when JFK is referring back to the rights of man, he's very much referring back to revolutionary, the American Revolution, the notion of the huge role that the rights of man played with regards to that, which were very much imbued with kind of a conception of rights imagining or rights language that was very much linked to conceptions of God and the role of God in defining those rights or the mechanisms for enforcing those rights. Now, my perspective is very different because obviously international human rights law, which is my area of specialisation, but indeed human rights law generally, isn't identical to the notion of rights that was set out for, you know, that for instance played such a central role in the Declaration of Independence, for instance, nor are they identical with, for instance, the civil rights movement that would have been developing in the States at the time.
JFK referred to God in that famous address. The Irish, the American Constitution mm-hmm. doesn't. The Irish Constitution does. It actually does refer to God, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, yeah. I suppose the most interesting place to look is the preamble. And, for instance, you've got in the preamble a reference to the Most Holy Trinity, from whom is all authority, which makes it very clear that God is regarded, and you know, a Catholic Christian conception of God is perceived as being the ultimate source of power under the Constitution and also of rights.
You spoke at the Parnell Summer School, as I said earlier in the week, and you chose to apply the term human rights to the current crisis, economic crisis mm-hmm. here, and the austerity measures. I mean, resources are very tight at the moment. We know this, mm-hmm. we're told repeatedly. Is it possible to operate within strict budgetary parameters and to maintain the conditions necessary for human rights to prevail?
Well, international human rights law, and indeed human rights law generally, is very pragmatic. And if you look at the way, for instance, rights under international human rights law to do with housing, to do with social security and education are phrased, it's made very clear that while the state is required to do the maximum that it can to advance those rights within the resources available to it, the fact that there's a reference to the resources available to the state reflects the awareness of the people who drafted and signed up to the treaty that there will be times when the state can do more and times when the state can do less. So the point that I made in the paper is that how the extent to which states can give effect to their human rights obligations will vary depending on the resources they have, or the amount of money or whatever else they have available to them, the obligations themselves don't go away. They don't disappear.
Are other countries who might be in similar financial straits, have they managed a better balance? Have they preserved their citizens' basic rights in a way perhaps that we haven't?
I think it's very interesting because obviously different countries face different obstacles. We certainly do see is that in countries in which there is very strong domestic protection of human rights, and particularly rights related to, say, labour, social security, housing, equality, that go beyond the kind of protections that we have in Ireland here under our constitution or under legislation, we see that the courts have been prepared to hold that certain austerity measures are unacceptable. The case that's got the most attention is probably the Portuguese case, where a number of austerity measures were struck out. But we see also decisions from over a range of crises at different times: Argentina, Latvia, Hungary, Germany, where we've had a number of cases dealing with perhaps not the kind of economic crisis Ireland is facing, but a demographic crisis, which would have translated into an economic crisis because of an ageing society. And the existence of these domestic protections, which of course are, you know, in place because of a process ultimately mediated by the state and that are given force by the state through its actions, has meant that courts have been prepared to make decisions. But perhaps it also has meant, in addition to courts, that advocacy groups can point to those standards and actually say, well, you know, such and such a measure that you're taking in response to the crisis violates this rights protection. So it gives them a tool. But finally, I would say the most important thing is that, you know, rights for advocates, rights for, you know, as they engage with courts, will only get you so far. The key thing about having a strong range of rights protection for the, you know, dealing with the rights of the most vulnerable and in the context of austerity to do with survival needs is the fact that they provide clear mandates for the government to steer their lawmaking, their policy making, their budget making along rights-based lines. And of course, that means that it's not the courts reacting, it's the government from the beginning saying, well, this is how we will tackle, this is how we will respond to the crisis, here are the parameters within which we are working, and this is as far as we can go slash will go. And in a way, the failure of the government to use the protections that we have here in order, for instance, to deal with the, you know, issues around the bailout or the European Stabilisation Mechanism, is in sharp contrast with other countries where the governments have been more willing to point to domestic legal constraints and say, well, actually, this is, you know, we have specific parameters within which we can work under our own constitutional or legal system.
But isn't there a danger in that sense that if you were to go to the Troika and say, well, we can't do that because of specific, you know, human rights legislation or whatever, the Troika is likely to say, well, you know, thank you very much, but we're now cutting off, you know, 15% of your funding as a consequence of that.
What I would say is that certainly you don't see, I would be very surprised if you saw states saying, well, actually, our constitutional system requires this and this. Sorry, let me take that back. If a state argues that something comes from their constitution, we have seen ourselves about how there have been constitutional amendments addressing different elements. However, if you had a state that was to turn around and say, well, actually, we're not prepared to do this because it, you know, it eats into absolutely fundamental rights. You know, for instance, do you remember the story of the child passing out from hunger in Cork, for instance, growing homelessness, etc.? And then if the EU was to turn around and say, well, actually, we're insisting you do this. That's very interesting because, first of all, it would be absolutely appalling PR for the EU and be very surprising if it happened. But what's interesting is, in fact, what's much more likely to happen is that the EU will turn around and say, well, fine, here are the parameters, work within them. What's striking is that even when the EU Troika, excuse me, and I should say the Troika, not the EU, sets the parameters, the state here is not necessarily reacting in a way to maximise rights protection, even within the scope it has. So it's not the EU is, what the state would like to say is actually, oh, well, the Troika is making us do this. But what has become evident from things such as the fact that we have made decisions about tax breaks, there was a piece last week about, lobbying groups ensuring, you know, cuts, you know, incentives for the financial industry and budget breaks. And what's clear there is that essentially it is the government that is claiming that the Troika is saying, actually, you have to do this. You know, you have to make these decisions that cut on social protection, etc. But in fact, it's that the government is making that decision itself within the parameters.
How do we stand in terms of the protection of human rights, the recognition, first off, I suppose, of human rights in terms of equality legislation? And how much of that, how much of the corpus of legislation that we do have at the moment is down to our own recognition of that, or as opposed to it being down to the imposition or impositions from outside, from the European Union?
Well, our equality legislation and our constitutional system are our own. Certainly, I'm unaware, but I'm not, my area isn't necessarily equality legislation, but I am certainly at the constitutional level. But within the equality context, EU equality law has essentially strengthened the very limited equality protection we had under the Constitution. So it certainly isn't a case of rights being imposed on us externally. It's, you know, we have our own rights mechanism frameworks, and we've also gone beyond that by signing up to a range of both European and international human rights.
So the basis was there to begin with.
Absolutely. And the state voluntarily assumed those obligations.
Aoife Nolan, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Aoife Nolan is a professor of international human rights law at the University of Nottingham.